everybody. This is Armand DeMille with you at The Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM on your dial. Today we want to talk to you about addiction. Yep, a new angle to addiction. You know, you've always wondered about our society and people and what it's like to live in this world. It's pretty hard to live in this world without being numb. You know, we all want to be numb in some way or other. Everybody looks to find something to get involved in. It could be anything. It could be, you know, your hobby. It could be something that you choose to do, or it could be something that's compulsive. Something that you don't have a choice, you just have to do it. Those things we call addictions. Addictions are something that just you are driven to do. So love addiction is a definite thing if it's about you have to have love. Sex addiction. But more usually when we talk about addiction, we talk about alcohol and drugs. And what I've watched over the years as a practitioner is I've watched so many people going to programs, program after program. The guy does too much drugs. He gets in trouble. They send him to a program. He goes to the program for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, according to how much money he could afford. You know, how long the insurance will keep you there, 90 days, whatever it is, then they send him out, and there's not really very good chance that he's going to stay clean. So, something about addiction is missing. We're missing something about the treatment of addiction. And we discovered, or we received, a new piece of work called Healing the Addicted Brain with Dr. Harold Urschel, U-R-S-C-H-E-L, the third, M-D. Should we call you Harold Urschel or the third? Hi there.
Call me Hal or Dr. Urschel, whatever you want.
Good.
Hal's fine.
Hal is good. Hal, we discovered something about addiction that we didn't know. We may have known, but we didn't think about it. When I was a kid, I remember people laying around taking LSD and saying to each other, you know, this may cause brain damage. And then when we were kids, they would also be doing, they smoked marijuana, and they would say, oh, this could cause brain damage. And everybody would talk about brain damage, you know, and it was like a joke. Oh, yeah, brain damage. What we're finding out is that there is, that addictions do in some way have physical effects on a long-range constitution of the human brain.
Yes, absolutely. The latest science has shown that alcohol and drug addiction, when you actually get addicted to the substance, the brain is injured just like another, and you develop a chronic disease in your brain, and that's what addiction is, and that's why it doesn't tend to go away over time, that you need to get treatment for a long period of time, just like you would for diabetes or asthma. And so the alcohol and drugs actually injure the brain. The good news is, though, if you can stay off the substance and allow the brain some respite from the injury, the brain can actually heal itself by itself, or even faster if you use the right nutrition, sort of comprehensive approach. You can actually accelerate some of that healing, and people can regain a lot of what they lost over time.
But why is it important to consider the physical damage? First of all, you know, the actual injury to the brain. Why is it? Because without thinking about it, we can't treat it. We don't treat it well. We just treat it by, let's sit down and talk about, you know, that therapy is usually, let's see how bad I can make you feel for taking drugs so that you'll eventually stop taking them.
Right.
You know.
So, right. The talking therapy, like you just mentioned, that's really a logic based system, and the logic part of the brain is in the cortex, the outer part, the sort of squiggly part, if you're looking at it, you know, from the outside, and problem is, although that's injured somewhat from alcohol and drug use, what's really injured is a part of the brain deep in the brain called the limbic system. And the limbic system is sort of a little blue ball kind of in the middle, right in the core. It's sort of the operation or control center of your brain, deep in your brain. And that's in that part of the brain is where you feel the high, the euphoria, the drunk feeling. Okay? And so when you take alcohol or drugs, they go to that center part of the brain, the limbic system, cause you to feel high and good, and that's why you continue to use them. At the same time, though, they're especially injuring the cells around in that area. And so over time, injure, over years or sometimes months, depending on the substance, you become addicted. The injury gets to a certain level, and after that, basically, you now have this compulsion. You have this inability to stop just based on logic.
Just break it down a little more for me, if you don't mind, Hal. We're talking with Hal Hirschfeld, who has written the book Healing the Addicted Brain, Revolutionary New Science-Based Alcoholism and Addiction Approach. So, Hal, when you say damage the cells, what do you mean damage the cells? You mean inhibited the protein synapse? The protein synthesis?
Well, I think, again, we're not sure exactly what we, being the scientists, aren't sure exactly what's happening. The imaging technologies we have are just starting to give us a lot of the clues, but we don't have enough data to show us exactly what's happening. However, we do know that alcohol, if we just take alcohol, which is by far the biggest, 800-pound gorilla in the field. I mean, we hear all the time about alcohol and drugs and the problem with drugs, cocaine and marijuana and heroin, all that stuff. But actuality, all of that amount of drug use and drug addiction, that's dwarfed by about a factor of 10 by alcohol. I mean, alcohol, because it's legal, we have 10 times more alcoholics than we have drug addicts. If you put all the drug addicts together and all the alcoholics together, the alcoholics outnumber the drug addicts by about 10 to 1.
What about the potency of the drug itself, the alcohol versus something like cocaine?
I was just going to say the alcohol itself, I had that whole preamble there for alcohol. And when the alcohol molecule touches a cell in your body, whether it's a brain or whatever, that cell blows up through something called an osmotic gradient. So that cell dies. Now, thankfully, we have billions and billions of cells. But think about it this way, what's kind of crazy about drinking alcohol. Let's just say that you're not in recovery. Say you don't have an addiction problem and you're going out camping in the Rocky Mountains. Okay? And you throw a bottle of Jim Beam in the backpack for a couple drinks around the fire. Now, if you're not an alcoholic, could be very appropriate, et cetera. You're going out to relax, so you do that. About 4 hours out of the parking lot, let's say you fall and you break your arm. Or not break your arm. You cut your arm really badly. So you reach in your backpack and you realize you left your first aid kit in the car. But right where the first aid kit was supposed to be, you see the Jim Beam. So what do you do? After you stop the bleeding, you take the Jim Beam and you pour it on the wound. Why? Because the alcohol kills the bacteria. Alcohol is an antiseptic. It kills cells. That's why you do it. Then what you do is you bandage up your arm after it's nice and clean and sterile from the alcohol. Go on about your business. Go up, set up camp, sit around the fire, drink your Jim Beam, and you're pouring that antiseptic into your system. So what is it doing inside? It's killing cells too. So in general, that's why this over time, the alcohol will damage the brain and other, it damages, in alcoholism, alcohol will damage your heart, your bones, your muscles. It really damages a lot of different things. But point is, all those things will heal if you can just keep alcohol out of your system and put the right nutrition and other wellness-focused products into your system so it can rebuild itself.
Well, the cells that it's killing, I mean, I'm thinking about New Year's Eve and what's going to happen to all those poor people out there with the martinis.
Right.
And I say, oh, poor Hal's looking at them and saying, oh, you poor kid, I hope you make it through tomorrow.
Most people, remember, most people that drink alcohol, 93% of them don't become alcoholics. Only about 7% do. That's probably underreported, but those are the statistics right now. Okay? So most people that drink alcohol don't get addicted. most people that drink alcohol, when they do drink it, it is killing some cells. It kills the cells in the mouth and all down esophagus and your intestines and blah, 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 and your bloodstream. But we have billions of cells. And so it's not terrible if you go out and have a couple martinis. But you have to remember that it is an antiseptic. It's an antiseptic you're putting in your body.
So I guess it has to do with the catecholamines. I think it has to do with the fact that you are probably going to be able to repair the cell damage given time in between. But if you constantly bombard yourself, right, you don't get a chance to do the repair. You don't get the esterase.
Right.
You don't get the cleanup.
That's probably true. It also has to do with genetics, because if you have alcoholism in your family, like if you have any other chronic disease, you have more of a genetic susceptibility. So it's easier to become addicted. So on average, if you don't have a strong genetic loading in your family, a lot of alcoholics in your family tree, it takes about 5 to 7 years of pretty heavy or regular drinking to become an alcoholic. 5 to 7 years. If you got a lot of people in your family that have, alcoholism, so you're more susceptible, it may only take 3 years. But it there's not some magic number. And unfortunately, right now, we still don't have the ultimate brain scan or blood test to say, hey, you're an alcoholic and you're not.
What we have been able to do is look at people. We've noticed that certain cultures are more sensitive to alcohol than others.
Sure.
Right?
A lot of the Orientals can have a certain enzyme that makes them more sensitive to alcohol.
Yes, and so that's possible. This is a pretty strong statement about alcohol versus what about the other drugs? What about cocaine?
Well, cocaine, heroin, methamphetamine, they're all toxic to the body, and for a variety of different reasons. Usually drugs, you can become addicted to drugs quicker than alcohol in general, although it just depends on the person and the circumstances, et cetera. But probably the most destructive drug of abuse as far as the brain is probably the inhalants. When you're sniffing and huffing the gas or the super glue or what fumes or whatever. But sort of the next one is methamphetamine. Methamphetamine is very toxic to the brain. And the brain damage from that can take up to a year and a half to get better. And, to get back to approaching normal, if you can have that, extended sobriety. So each type of substance injures the brain in a different way, each different class. But at the end of the day, they all injure the limbic system. And consequently, in 7% of the people that use, you're going to have this disease. And the whole point of the book is to say, look, if you get the disease, this is what you need to do to get it treated.
I'll just stick with the definition for just a moment.
Sure.
So with somebody having ADHD,
ADHD, right.
ADHD, right, the treatment of choice is usually methamphetamines of some sort.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what we give to the kids. What are we doing to
I think they're usually, and again, I'm not an ADHD specialist, they're usually amphetamines, not methamphetamines.
No, the latest one I was looking at today, what was it called, Stephanie, remember? Phylloxylin or something, which is the latest one, which is a methamphetamine. This is what we're doing, just fry the kid's brain so the kid won't be so active.
But again, I think I'm not an expert on the ADHD medicines. I know that all the science shows that if you have ADHD or ADD and you're treated appropriately, you have a much with stimulants, you have a much lower chance of becoming addicted to stimulants in the future than if you don't get treated. If you have ADHD and you don't get treated, and you have a higher chance of using drugs because you in general, and so you may end up using methamphetamine or cocaine or other things that are quite destructive to your brain because they calm you down and you're not getting the right medicines that you need. Now, again, that's not. I'll just be very forthright. That's not one of my areas of expertise, but in general, the methamphetamine. Remember, the other thing is, the drug dealers on the streets, they don't have a whole lot of high quality control. You don't really know what's in the substance you're buying and you're putting in your arm or your mouth or.
Oh, for sure.
And so consequently, a lot of the toxicities is from what is being mixed, what the substance is being mixed with. So that can really complicate everything on top of just the standard substance.
So addiction itself is the process whereby somebody takes something, a substance, maybe alcohol or so, they get a certain feeling from it. They like the feeling. You know, I was watching yesterday somebody, a comedy skit about somebody drinking for the first time, and she just kind of really enjoyed this feeling that came over her as these certain cells were getting anesthetized or killed or whatever.
Right.
And you get this nice, pleasant feeling, and some people come back for more, and other people just say, well, that's for the moment, it's New Year's Eve, and that's it, tomorrow we don't do it. There, this is where I think the emotional makeup of the person or the personality plays a big difference. I don't. Or do you think there are just some people are destined to become addicts and other people are not based on some physiological thing? Or do you think the emotional base is what makes the difference?
You know, I think you actually have both cases. I think that although we'd like to have simple cause and effect, I think that especially because of the human genome and all the advances we've made in the neurological sciences and genetics, I bet within about 10 years we will be able to find that we have this 15 to 20 different subtypes of alcoholics, and maybe 10 or maybe another the same number of subtypes of narcotic addicts, maybe 5 or 10 different types of cocaine addicts. So there's people, some groups of some of those subtypes will have more of a personality focus. Some of them will have more of a genetic in their background. Some of them will be have fallen in with the wrong peer group. Some of them will have had a particularly, you know, uncomfortable psychiatric disorder that wasn't treated effectively, so they were using the substance to help themselves feel better temporarily.
Yeah, so we know
there's a variety of ways. Mm-hmm. There's all kinds of roads that lead to addiction. The problem is, once you injure the brain, you have the disease, similar to diabetes. There's a variety of ways to get diabetic, but once you get diabetes, you know, you have that illness and you need to treat it long term. Hmm. And there's different subtypes of diabetes, there's different subtypes of high blood pressure, different subtypes of cardiac, you know, ischemia, of heart attacks or heart insufficient, you know, blood flow to your heart. And so I think the same thing is with addiction.
Could you give an example of some of the subtypes of addiction that we've already begun to see, or in alcoholism that we've seen?
Well, yeah, like for alcohol. Unfortunately, most of them are still behavioral. We haven't looked at them in, you know, the subtypes genetically. But there's a type A and a type B alcoholic. A type A is one that tends to become an alcoholic much earlier in life. That tends to have a certain set of more risk factors versus the type B happens later in life and tends to, you know, not do as poorly as the type A's. It's physician scientists and researchers that are trying to categorize behaviorally something that's going on in the head. And so I think we don't have a lot of accurate clinically relevant subtypes. We just know that there are some subtypes, and there definitely will be more, I think, in the future. But right now, for cocaine and methamphetamine, they're all treated as the same. Opiate addicts are treated as the same, although we know we have, you know, multiple types of opiate receptors in our brain, and multiple types of different opiate pills hit different receptors. So one person may be a Vicodin addict, and one person may be a fentanyl addict, and one person may be Demerol addict with different receptors components in your brain that are being affected.
Well, how exactly would that work? You know, it's kind of sure we have different receptors in the brain, but let's say you did Vicodin or Percocet or Demerol. Let's say we took those three and you said, okay, all three of these can numb me out, and if I'm feeling pain, I could take these, and they're kind of all related indirectly. Certainly, the Percocet and the Vicodin are. Are you saying that there are two different receptors for Percodan and Vicodin, Vicodin and Percocet, that they have different receptors, or is it the same opiate receptor?
Well, no, there's multiple different types. You know, there's delta, there's kappa, there's mu, there's all types of opiate receptors. We have multiple types of endorphins and enkeplins in our brain. You know,
Thank you. This I don't know about. So if you could explain a little of that to us.
Okay. So basically, you have different categories of the opiate system in your brain is very important for pain control, well-being, depression, a lot of other things. And so what happens is your body makes different types of internal opiate molecules. Some are endorphins, some are enkephalins. I don't know the basic science between enough to delineate the difference, but I just know there's multiple different types of internal molecules that the body makes, and each of those molecules have different types of receptors. And when the different receptors are stimulated, you get different results. Sometimes you have receptors that decrease pain in the opiate system. There's other types of receptors like kappa receptors. So the main receptor in your brain for opiates that people talk about is the mu. It's a Greek symbol receptor, and that's the one that helps. When that one's activated, you get decreased anxiety, you get decreased pain, you get more of a euphoria, et cetera.
You feel like a cow, like moo.
Yeah, you get very relaxed.
Moo,
that's right. Okay, I got it. The kappa, however, if when you stimulate that, you actually get some dysphoria. You actually feel worse.
Uh-huh.
Your pain might actually get a little bit worse if they're stimulated. And it goes on and on. And again, I'm not a basic scientist.
When the kappas, if you don't mind, when the kappas get stimulated, how might that manifest? Would that be aggression behavior and anger?
It might be irritability, anxiety, and pain.
And the
reason this is important is like one of the treatments, one of the new science-based treatments for opiate addiction is a medicine called Suboxone. And the Suboxone is not a mu receptor agonist. It doesn't activate the mu receptor fully. It's only a partial activation. And then we think that it also may actually activate the kappa receptor. So what that does is it's activating both receptors, and so the kappa, the dysphoria, the uncomfortable, the bad feeling, the negative, you feel worse, you feel uncomfortable, you don't like the way you feel. That feeling is sort of negates the positive feeling from the mu, and so you get a normal feeling.
The Suboxone, of course, is a very popular drug with people with opiate addictions because what it does is it blocks the effects of the opiates, does it not?
It does a variety of things. One is it will sit on the receptor and tricks the receptor into thinking that it's an opiate on the receptor, so there's no craving. So your cravings go away. That's the biggest benefit of it.
You also get a little high from it, don't you?
No, you don't. The only time you can get high from Suboxone is if you inject it in somebody that's not an opiate addict. But why would you ever do that?
Well, because people like to get high.
Well, but if you're going to do that, you might as well inject OxyContin. You're going to get a much more bang for your buck if you're going to go, and it's a lot cheaper. And I mean, it's a lot easier to get.
What I've heard with the Suboxone is I've heard people completely unable to stop it. The new problem that they have it and it blocks the opiate.
That's not true. A great question. That's actually pretty inaccurate. A lot of times, if they can't get off of it, that means that proves my point earlier.
Good.
A lot of times, the opiate addiction, when you're taking these heroin or other narcotics illegally and you become addicted to them, your opiate system is injured. And so you put the Suboxone in the system and you feel normal again for the first time sometimes in 20 years. You don't want to use. You want to sit in treatment. You want to get better. You can do the talking therapy and learn the new coping skills. And the other perk of Suboxone is if you try and shoot up heroin when you're on Suboxone, you don't feel anything. It's like pouring $300 down the tube. And so that's a fabulous benefit. But the Suboxone is just tricking the receptor, making it think that there's some opiate on the receptor. It's not. It's sort of a fake opiate. And so over time, for most opiates, over time, the longer you're on an opiate, the more you need. That's called tolerance. So whereas, maybe one pill works for a while a couple months, and after a couple months with no other change in anything, you might need two pills to achieve the same effect. So that's called tolerance. Well, with Suboxone, you actually get reverse tolerance. The longer you on it, the less you need.
Jesus, that's not what we've seen around here.
Well, but again, a lot of people are not using Suboxone effectively.
That's right. What you're doing is going to a psychiatrist who says, well, let's try Suboxone since you're taking Percocet or since you're taking heroin. And so the regulation and not having the information, the knowledge that you would have, the program that would be there, the being able to judge and map the brain, you know, being able to see maybe even physical evidence of it. Without that, you're just throwing something at somebody and saying, here, take Suboxone. This should get rid of your problem.
Well, but let me tell you, Suboxone is a lot better to have than somebody shooting heroin, without question. Okay, so if a psychiatrist is using Suboxone and they don't have training, there's a way to get more training. If you use the book is able, we have a 5 or 6 pages on Suboxone of how to use it, what you're supposed to do. But remember, treating heroin addiction or narcotic addiction or any addiction, it's not about a medicine by itself.
That's right.
It's not a silver bullet. It's the Suboxone plus a treatment program, plus a 12-step program, plus making sure your depression or anxiety, your psychiatric symptoms are addressed, plus wellness and nutrition, making sure you're having the right diet, the right vitamins, the right exercise program, the right family therapy. It's a comprehensive approach. That's what all the latest science is showing. So, again, somebody just using Suboxone by themselves, they're not going to do well any more than if you have diabetes and you just use insulin, okay, and you still eat birthday cake and drink Cokes and you don't lose weight and you don't wear shoes, okay, you're still not going to do very well managing your diabetes either. That doesn't mean that insulin doesn't work. That means that the illness is not being treated effectively, and that's the main message of what we're trying to get across in the book and then the website that's associated with it. Is, look, guys, this is a chronic disease of the brain. That's what it is. If you treat it as such, you change your lifestyle, you use the latest medications, you use the latest nutrition and wellness programs, you're going to get better, and you have a high chance, maybe 90, 95% chance of achieving long-term sobriety. Unfortunately, in most treatment programs out there, that's not what's happening. Most treatment programs are just saying, hey, you're an addict, cocaine, heroin, alcohol doesn't make any difference. You're just going to get 12 steps. That's all we're going to do. Look, there's nothing wrong with 12 steps, but the 12 steps by themselves are usually not sufficient to treat this chronic illness.
There's a hole in the bucket.
Yeah, there's a hole. But it's just saying you need this comprehensive approach. And so, you know, I'm so glad you're asking me questions about the Suboxone because there's so much misinformation out there about it that people aren't using it, and it's a great medication when used in the right hands.
Well,
and
certainly greater than heroin or cocaine.
Yeah, absolutely.
Well, what about methadone? What about compared to methadone?
You know, that's an excellent question. Methadone is a very good treatment. It's life-saving. It has been life-saving. It's been around for a long time. The problem is methadone can cause euphoria. Methadone, the biggest challenge is you have to go to a methadone clinic to get it. And most methadone clinics only just give you the medicine. They don't give you any other treatment. And so, again, methadone in general does not work as well as Suboxone when it's Suboxone. Suboxone can be used by your primary care physician. You don't have to go to a clinic to get it, meaning a methadone clinic. You can go to your doctor's office. If you go through and you're going to your 12-step programs and your outpatient program, you're doing that comprehensive approach, you get a script for Suboxone for a whole month.
But, you know, I mean,
that's a big difference.
That may be a difference, you go every day
to the clinic.
That may make a big difference. We have to take a short break. But when we come back, we'll talk more. But what you're saying, Hal, I think is very important. I think the comprehensive approach is the only way because we've tried all these one shots with so many people. I've seen Suboxone not work. I've seen all the other medications not work. I've seen therapy not work. I've seen groups not work. I've seen 12-step not work. And I've seen them work at the same time.
Yep.
But I think that's just like a shot. But, you know, when I say there's a hole in the bucket, I kind of mentioned it. It's like it's such a deep thing that just you sometimes feel so powerless with, especially if you're one of the people who are trying very hard to help somebody with it. You don't know which way to go. So the book, Healing the Addicted Brain by Hal Urschel. We're going to come back with Dr. Urschel in a minute and talk much more about this, especially about the emotional parts related to it. We'll be right back. This is Armand Mill.
W-B-A. We're the New Orleans Jazz Vipers at WBAI.
Children, this is Reverend Billy from the Church of Stop Shopping. You're listening to WBAI FM 99.5, New York City. It's listener-sponsored, children. It's commercial-free. Ooh, change-a-looyah.
I work 9 to 5 at Stars in the PM, and I love the sunrise, so I step out in the AM. The street is black and shiny from the nightly rain. The glory of the light brings evaporation. Morning's fresh, oxygen pleased. I take a deep breath, help my mind stay the greenest. I'm already awake, so I'm not drinking coffee. Don't want a cigarette, cause it's a form of slavery. Walk into the store, cause I need a few items. The sun heats my blood, like it hit the vitamins. I need to buy some food for my dreads. I can't remember why, but I need a spool of thread. Well, a man with dirty dreads, he steps around the corner. He asked me for a dime, a nickel or a quarter. I don't have any change, so I'm stepping along. But as I'm walking past, he sings to me a song.
There's a hole in a bucket, and there's a hole in a bucket, there's a hole in a bucket, there's a hole in a bucket, there's a hole.
Shopkeeper, I say, what's up? And I'm thinking about the man who's holding up the cup. I pay for all the stuff and get a pocket full of change. Well, should I give it to the man's a question in my brain. What's gonna happen if I give the man a dime? I don't wanna pay for another brother's wine. What's gonna happen if I give the man a quarter? Will he find a dealer and try to place an order? What's gonna happen if I give the man a nickel? Will he buy some food or some pork that's been picked? I'm not responsible for the man's depression. How can I find compassion in the midst of a recession? How can all these questions keep stepping through my head? And I still can't remember why I need a spool of thread.
There's a hole in the bucket. There's a hole in the bucket. There's a hole in the bucket.
Should put it in his bag. I walk right past to think about it more. Back at the crib, I'm opening up the door. A pocket full of change don't mean a lot to me. My cup is half full, but his is empty. I put back on my cap and I start heading back. I reach into my pocket and I have a heart attack. Well, as I'm digging deep, I scream, oh no, there's nothing in the pocket but a great big hole.
Bucket, Eliza. That's Spearhead. It really touches the feeling of it, you know. When you're related to someone, this is Armand DeMille with you with A Positive Mind here on WBAI 99.5 FM. Hey, by the way, just as an announcement, there is still an opening for somebody who knows bookkeeping. We're looking to have somebody in a project. If you know bookkeeping and you're familiar with WBAI, please give us a call here at the DeMille Center or send me an email, armand@brainlink.com. Now, bookkeeping, organizing, trying to keep yourself together, trying to keep your mind in place, it's very, very tough. It's very tough looking at your own addictions. Anosognosia. You remember that word? Anosognosia. It's a condition in which a person who suffers a disability denies the existence of his or her disability. And so often, addiction is anosognosic. You know, because, you know, you could be somebody who could be eating pizza and say, I don't have a problem with this. You could be somebody who's drinking and saying, no, I don't have a problem with this. So denial, which is one of the effects of it, but it gets to a point where you're just so completely blind to it. Addiction kind of carries its own blinders with it. It kind of, I think, though, sometimes, you know, whenever a person becomes an addict, they have, along with it, a personality that's there to defend the addiction. So once you become an addict, then you grow this personality that's there to defend the addiction. I'll give you an example of that. I remember when I used to smoke cigarettes. I used to smoke cigarettes, and I say, I think I'll stop smoking. And as I was saying it, I would be lighting a cigarette. My hand would be reached, somebody would be pulling a cigarette out of a pack, and I'd start smoking again. I think I'll give up this. And as soon as I would do that, some part of me would counter it in some way. So I think there are forces inside of us. I think once the body gets accustomed to an addiction, I think damages do take place. And I think with those damages, we're trying to learn new ways of how to counter the effects of the damages. We're talking today with the good graces of Hal Hirschell, who's sticking with us, who wrote this beautiful book called Healing the Addicted Brain, which covers some of the new research around addiction. And if, my friends, you wanted to get a Christmas present for a friend who is related to someone, this is the book to do it, because certainly you can't give a book called Healing the Addicted Brain to somebody who's an addict, because that other guy, the guy who runs around protecting the addiction, is just going to throw it out or sell it. And Hal, you still with us?
Yes, I sure am.
How do you like that music, Hal? Hole in the Bucket.
It's very, very mesmerizing, actually.
It kind of goes along with it, which is just
right.
Just goes with it. Hal, just for a moment, if you would, emotions. You specify thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, and you separate them out. How do you see them?
Well, you know, what I'm talking about is something, a theory in psychiatry called cognitive behavioral therapy. And what that says is that your thoughts, your thinking, actually cause a lot of your emotions. That if you're getting angry, that you're having some thought behind in your head that's causing you to get angry. And then once you have that emotion, you get angry, that's when you throw something or you hit somebody or whatever. And so you have the thoughts control your emotion, or your thoughts cause your emotions cause the behavior, and unfortunately, a lot of times, people don't know that the thoughts are going on in their head, and consequently, they'll just feel angry, and they'll act out, and the problem with that is it's kind of hard to stop it. Once you get to the point where you're in talking therapy, this type of therapy, cognitive behavioral therapy, allows you to helps you identify what thoughts are you having and making you so mad. One of the things we believe as humans is, hey, I'm thinking something, so it must be true. I think, you have a woman that's having trouble, that to everybody else looks normal weight. She says, I'm fat. No matter what you tell her, she says she thinks she's fat, and therefore she acts like it and says, I need to lose 10 more pounds.
But you said a little while ago that there are certain receptors in the brain that if a person kind of triggers the amygdala and they have a kind of hyperactive response, you might feel angry without having a thought. Isn't it possible that the body triggers an aggressive response first, and then you say, I'm nervous and I'm angry, I wonder why I'm angry, and then the thought comes in?
Well,
I don't think it's always thought first.
You're right. And again, the brain science is still at the very early stage. But that your question actually goes to my main point of the book is you need to address this comprehensively. If you're having some damaged part of your brain causing irrational thoughts, you can't just talk about those irrational thoughts. You need medications to help quell those thoughts or to help heal that part of the brain. Okay? Even once that's addressed, you still have other thoughts about, hey, I'm a failure. I'm never going to beat this disease. I'm never going to get through my next paycheck without using. You're going to have all these other thoughts that are going on in your head. A lot of those can be challenged, fixed, and changed, and all of a sudden you say, I can beat this illness. I can get my next paycheck because I'm going to get my wife to go with me, and she's going to pick it up. I'm not going to pick it up, therefore I'm not going to blow it, so we're going to have money for the next 2 weeks.
Hal, if somebody comes to you and they say to you, look, I've got this problem with alcohol. I know how well you work with chemistry, how well you work with giving people medications, but I don't want to take another medication. I want to get off this without the medication. Please help me. How can you and your programs that you sponsor, if somebody refuses to do it, what could you say to them? There's no hope?
No, absolutely not. Basically, it says, If you use just a talking therapy approach, if you're just using...
Not just talking, whatever else that you would do.
Okay,
you know?
Again, I guess the same answer you would have is if you had diabetes and you say, hey, I want all the treatments for diabetes, but I don't want to take insulin, or I don't want to take any oral hypoglycemics. Okay, what are your chances? Well, you know, if you have a 95% chance of doing well in combination, all right, and you now pull out a major component, you may have a 30 or 40% decrease. That doesn't mean you can't get better. I mean, a lot of, you know, 30% of the people that just do 12 steps, they stay sober, 30%. But I mean, 70% die. You know, so when you can get a 90% response when you address this a disease like the disease it is, which do you want to do?
Well, sometimes I would, some people would say, I don't want to be part of the 90% that got there using chemicals that I don't know are having what affected me. That's what many people would say, and I would have respect for them.
Great point. That happens all the time in addiction. You have somebody that's buying cocaine off the street and injecting it into their veins with dirty needles or putting it into their lungs, and then they'll finally get sober, and you know, during that time causing all kinds of chaos in their job and their family and their health. And then they come in and say, Dr. Urschel, I don't want to take this medicine that we know has gone through an FDA approval process and has very high quality control. We know there's no contaminants. I don't want to put anything in my body that would hurt it.
Absolutely.
How crazy is that?
Well,
then what I do is I'll interpret it to them. I'll say, look, let's just go through what you said. They'll actually most of the time laugh and say, that's pretty ridiculous, isn't it? I said, yeah, it is.
It's the addictive guy talk.
It's the lack of judgment. And it's a matter of saying, hey, the research scientists have shown that this medicine, in partnership with other treatments, can really make a big difference.
I understand, but I think you understand also that there's a number of significant people who have been promised throughout their lives that this one particular treatment will help them long term, only to find out later that they're having genetic problems or stuff like that. So there are a lot of people who are skeptical, and a lot of people who, once they get themselves caught into a loop like this, could use a lot of your information being aware of, rather than just saying, look, you know, you got a 30% chance if you take this drug. Like, let's say kids, you have children. And you have a children who's hyperactive, and you say, okay, we have a hyperactive child. Let's give this child Ritalin. Right? Or let's give this child, maybe change their environment, bring them out to the country, and try something different with them. Well, the odds are the Ritalin is going to work better. But you may just want to take your kid out to the country.
No, absolutely. And I think what I want to say is, look, like you said very well, you can adopt what science has shown, and you can pull out different components the medication or this particular type of therapy or this wellness or whatever, or you don't want to treat your depression, or you have bipolar disorder but you don't really believe it, so you don't want to address it, so you won't go to the psychiatrist. That's all your choice. But if you add all these other components in, you'll definitely have a pretty good response. But if you can't stay sober, then the data shows maybe you need to up the intensity of treatment. Hey, at least the whole point of my book and then the website EnterHealth, the whole point is this. Most people will go to a treatment program, and all they'll be offered is 12 steps. They'll never hear about how that you have to treat your depression, that you have to treat your family therapy, that you have to look at these medications are available, and they're non-addicting, and they can really make a huge difference. And you know, nobody's told this. And yet the science has been out there, and these treatments have been around sometimes for 5 or 10 years. And so that's where this show and the things we're discussing today can make a big difference in people's lives, because they may choose not to use the medication component of it. That's completely fine. If they can stay sober with everything else, great, because the end result is you want to stay sober, right? The longer you stay sober, the better your brain will heal. And if after 3 or 4 months of trying it their way, they, you know, at a 60% response rate, they find they start relapsing again, then they say, hey, maybe I'll go try this medicine. This thing, because I've tried everything else, and they add that medicine, and voila, it makes a big difference. That could be their choice.
Yes. How if somebody were to go to an ideal addiction, let's say you had somebody who was a full blown
alcoholic,
right? Yep. And they wanted to go into a treatment. Are there treatment centers now that incorporate this full range of treatments that do not, on an inpatient basis? I mean, is there a 2 or 3 week program that people can currently do that include all of this stuff?
Yes, there's one we created here in Dallas as the first prototype. It's called EnterHealth, EnterHealth.
And what do you do?
Basically, we assess people. We assess, okay, you come, you're an alcoholic. We assess, get a comprehensive assessment, and then we say, okay, based on this, we're going to, you know, give it. They're going to be put in the residential environment. We're going to choose the right anti-addiction medicine, if needed. We're going to choose the right wellness-specific exercise program, wellness nutrition program, address their family issues. Address, I don't know if I already said, the psychiatric issues if it's present. We're going to engage them on a variety of teaching them new coping skills. We're going to engage them in a spiritual component of the program. We're going to engage them in a 12-step component of the program. We're going to put all this together, and then we're going to work, while they're there, we're going to work with their families. While they're there, we're going to try and figure out the right place for them to go when they leave so they can continue everything they've learned here in their outpatient environment. And then they're all going to be linked up with the EnterHealth.com website, which will help to reinforce all these things they've learned out in the outpatient world. And it's the only one of its kind, unfortunately. I wish there were more, but the goal...
We'll be watching it closely. Look to see what happens. Yep. Can you give us one of the... There are people who have strong marijuana dependence, and, you know, even though it sounds benign, I mean, I've seen enough people walk and say, well, I smoke every day, I have marijuana every day.
Right.
And they know that their life is not working, and somehow the marijuana is working about them. Could we talk a little bit about marijuana?
Absolutely. I would love to. I just want to say, can we spend 1 or 2 minutes left at the end, if we have time, just on the new shot for alcoholism, because I want to make sure people are aware of that.
Sure, go there now.
Okay, great. There's just 1 minute, because we talked about Suboxone. The other really huge benefit is a medication, and I understand some of the audience isn't interested in the medication. There's a medicine called Vivitrol out there, V-I-V-I-T-R-O-L. It's about 6 or 7 pages about it in the book and on the website. And it really, what the Vivitrol does, 3 things. First, it's a shot. Okay, so it changes the paradigm. This is not so many people still think addiction's a moral weakness or a sin. If you go to the doctor and you get a shot, then hey, you don't get a shot for a sin. So it's a paradigm changing medication. But the shot lasts for 30 days. You only get it once a month. But each day during that month after you get it, it puts a little bit of medication into your body. The medication's called naltrexone. It's been around for about 60 years. The shot's new, but the medication's old. The medication does 3 things. Decreases your cravings for alcohol by 90%. If you do drink while you're on it, you don't get drunk. You don't feel anything. It's like alcohol's turned to water. So you can't get drunk for the 30 days. And third, if you do drink, you only want a drink or a half a drink, something like that. You don't want the whole case or two or three cases. It severely limits the amount of the alcohol that you use during a relapse. Three things: decrease cravings, prevents you from getting drunk, decreases the severity of relapse. Why wouldn't you use this? And it's not addicting. There's no euphoria. Why wouldn't you use this tool, at least for a period of time, to help you achieve sobriety while you're putting in place all these other things?
Because I've seen enough cases where the naltrexone doesn't work.
Well, but most of the time, naltrexone doesn't work because people don't take it. The naltrexone you've seen probably is an oral dose, right?
Sure.
And so this is a chronic disease. People have alcoholics all the time. Naltrexone, when you take it, really works. But the problem is sometimes it'll work so well that it really ticks you off because you want to get drunk and you can't, so you'll stop it clandestinely.
Absolutely. I understand that when it comes to addiction, like I said, there's the addiction, and then there's the addiction personality inside who's not going to make anything work. One of the first things that we've always seen, and I used to manage an addiction center, the cocaine consultation service we had, and during that time, one of the things we always found is that people would find fault with the agency itself.
Yes.
The first thing you do is find fault with the agency, then you find fault with everything else. Because when you're threatened, it's almost like life and death. When you're an addict and you're stuck in an addiction, your life is screaming out at you, please don't stop, please don't stop. It's a very difficult thing. Let's get a few minutes on marijuana.
Yes,
and what you
That'd
think
be great.
Of it.
So marijuana, you know, most people, there's such a huge perception out there that marijuana is not addicting. Well, you know, people, you got about a 5 to 7% of the people that do smoke marijuana do get addicted to it. Problem with marijuana is that it stays so long in your body, and I'm sure you've talked about this in the program before. It goes into your fat cells. The first thing is marijuana. The smoke, there's about 250 different substances in the smoke, only one of which is THC. So you don't know what the other 249 substances you're bringing into your body, okay? Now, that smoke from the marijuana is four times more carcinogenic than the smoke from your normal cigarette, all right? And so you have a four times higher chance of getting lung cancer if you're smoking marijuana from, you know, compared to a cigarette. And then on top of that, as a marijuana smoker, you hold the smoke in your lungs longer so you can get a better high. Meanwhile, all the carcinogens are attacking your lungs. That makes the chances of lung cancer for regular marijuana users that much higher. Okay, and then if you have the genetics for lung cancer, then you're even more at risk. So you have all those things. But once you smoke the marijuana, the THC molecule goes in your body, and that's what gives you the high. All right. Problem is, it builds up in it gets in your fat cells, and if you smoke it every day, if you smoke marijuana every day, what happens is if you say, hey, I realize this is a problem, or you get picked up, you know, for possession, and you got to stop. Once on the day you stop, let's say you stop on January 1st of 2010, it will take 42 days for the marijuana to clear your body. So you won't be finished with the marijuana out of your body till February 11th. Okay? And so consequently, it takes 3 weeks before you 3 weeks after you stop marijuana for you to feel any of the withdrawal. Now, 3 weeks to a drug addict is like, you know, three millennia, because, you know, they're so used to living in the moment, and a day is a long time for them. And so if you stop marijuana and you go for a week and say, look, I'm fine, I'm not getting any withdrawal symptoms, I'm not addicted, so they go back to smoking marijuana, but they didn't wait long enough for the symptoms to go away, or they may say, hey, you know, I've stopped marijuana, I've been sober now for 3 weeks, and all of a sudden they start getting the withdrawal symptoms, the insomnia, the irritability, the confusion, the difficulty of problem solving, all those things. They don't associate it as withdrawal. So they say, hey, since I'm not an addict, I'm anxious, I can't sleep, I'm going to go back to using pot. You have all these things about, it's a danger, it's a pretty, you know, very health noxious substance in the first place. Number two, it is addicting, but it's hard to see the addiction because it lasts in your body so long, you don't usually see the withdrawal.
And my guest is Dr. Hal. We have to be going.
Yes.
Dr. Hal Urschel, Healing the Addicted Brain. The website is enterhealth.com, www.enterhealth.com. Hal, I want to thank you. you for being with us. I think we may have to do more programming because I think we're going to have a little more discussion about this. Thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me today. I'd love to come back.
Sure. And be sure to tune in tomorrow, my friends. We're going to do some finally doing some of that work on sleep and some of the new dynamics and research we've learned about sleep. Have a little faith in us. Hey, thepositivemind.com, WBAI.org.
And Spearhead on WBAI. We're at 99.5 FM and we're available on the web at WBAI.org. Good afternoon. My name is Michael G. Haskins, your radio host and guide weekday afternoons. Coming up at 3 p.m. will be Talk Back with Hugh Hamilton. Coming up in just a moment, that's at 2 o'clock, the Arts Magazine. So stay tuned for that and keep your dial right where it is. 99.5 FM throughout the day, throughout the overnight, and certainly right now, within the last hour, I was letting you know about the station board election ballots being counted. Well, that process has been concluded. And if you go to our website, WBAI.org, on the front, on the homepage, it says the station board election results, December 14th, 2009, with the ballots counted and scanned. The results of 41 rounds of electronic single transfer vote counting are as follows. A listener candidate. Mitchell Cohen, elected first round. Lynn Stewart, elected first round. Alex Steinberg, elected second round. Mia Bediaco, elected third round. Andrea Fishman, elected fourth round. Russell Dale, elected fifth round. Elizabeth Brown, elected 38th round. Betty J. Dobson, elected 40th round. Manija Saba, elected 41st round. Now, there's a lot more. The staff results are there. I don't know whether they finished the counting of the staff or not, but those results are there. You can find out a lot more on our website, WBAI.org. That'll do it for me for the next 60 minutes or so. I'll turn the controls over to Peggy Dominique, and she will usher in the Arts Magazine here over WBAI.
The Stupak Amendment, the biggest attack on women's rights in a generation, and it's not over yet. On Thursday, December 17th at 11 a.m., join the joy of resistance with guest Terry O'Neill, president of the National Organization for Women, as we discuss how did we get into this mess and how do we get out of it. We'll also speak with Jamila Hoffman, a student who took on the right wing at the University of Houston. We'll play excerpts of the World Can't Wait conference panel on abortion and the Democratic Party woman-killing machine. And we'll bring you international feminist news.
Please remember that this program is supported by the listener members of WBAI New York. If you like what you hear, please consider becoming a member of WBAI or renewing if you've already joined. Basic membership is $25, but we accept any amount. Help us keep free speech alive.